authorities. I suggest you contact them. A colonel, Colonel Figueres. Yes, that is the name, I believe. Did John Everson pick up his mail at the embassy? I don't think, in any case, we don't encourage. Yes, I know. You are also not a post office. Would you mind calling the mail desk and asking if there are any letters their addresses to John Everson? Really, Mr. Snide? Really, Mr. Hill? I have been retained by an American citizen rather well connected, I may add, working on a U.S. government project retained to find an American citizen who is missing in your district. So far, there is no evidence of foul play, but it hasn't been ruled out. He was also the type who backs down under pressure. He reached for the phone. Could you tell me if there are any letters for John Everson at the desk? One letter. I slid a power of attorney across the desk, which authorized me, among other things, to pick up mail addressed to John Everson. He looked at it. A Mr. Snide will pick up the letter. He has authorization. He hung up. I stood up. Thank you, Mr. Hill. His nod was barely perceptible. On the way out of the office, I met that CIA punk from Athens. He pretended to be glad to see me, and shook hands and asked where I was staying. I told him at the Reforma. I could see he didn't believe me, which probably meant he knew where I was staying. I was beginning to get a bad feeling about the Everson case, like gathering vultures. I waited almost an hour to see Colonel Figueres, but I knew he was really busy. He'd been a major when I last saw him. He hadn't changed much. A little heavier, but the same cold gray eyes and focused attention. When you see him, he gives his whole concentration to you. He shook hands without smiling. I can't recall ever seeing him smile. He simply doesn't give himself occasion to do so. I told him I had come about the Everson boy's disappearance. He nodded. I thought you had, and I'm glad you are here. We haven't been able to give enough time to it. You think something may have happened to him? Figueres doesn't shrug. He doesn't gesticulate. He just sits there with his eyes focused on you and what is being discussed. I don't know. We have checked Progreso and all surrounding towns. We have checked airports and buses. If he had gone off on another dig, he would be that much easier to locate. A blonde foreigner off the tourist routes is very conspicuous. We have also checked all the tourist places. Apparently he was a level-headed, serious young man, no indications of drug use or excessive drinking. Is there any history of amnesia? Psychotic episodes? None that I know of. Dead end. Back at the hotel, Jim and Kiki had turned up very little from questioning the landlady and neighbors. The landlady described Everson as a serious, polite young man, un caballero. He entertained few visitors, and these were also serious students. There had been no noise, no drinking, no girls. I sat down and opened the letter. It was from his twin sister in Minneapolis. It read, "Querido Juanito. He has visited me again. He says that before you receive this letter he will have contacted you. He says you will then know what has to be done. Your ever-loving sister, Jane." At 3 o'clock, I called Inspector Graywood in New York. "Clem Snide here." Yes, Mr. Snide, there have been some developments in Lima. A boy did come to call for another crate and was seen to brush against the duplicate head crate. He was followed to a bicycle rental and repair shop in the Mercado Mayorista. Police searched the shop and found false identity papers in the name of Juan Mateus. The proprietor has been arrested and charged with possession of forged papers and with conspiracy to conceal evidence of a murder. He is being detained in isolation. He claims he did not know what was in the crate. He had been offered a fairly large sum to pick up the crate after it had cleared customs. The crate was to have been brought to his shop. Someone would arrange to pick it up there, and he would be paid an additional and larger sum. The customs agent who passed the crate has also been arrested. He has confessed to accepting a bribe. What about the boy? There was no reason to hold him in connection with this case. However, since he has a record for petty theft and a history of epilepsy, he has been placed in a rehabilitation center in Lima. I wish I could be on the scene. So do I, otherwise, I doubt if any important arrests will be made. In a country like that, people of wealth are virtually untouchable. People like the Countess de Gulpa, for example. So you know about her? Of course. The description of the man who contacted the customs broker tallies rather closely with your identikit picture of Marty Bloom. I have sent a copy to the Lima police and informed them that he is also wanted in connection with a murder here. Benson, it seems, was a pusher, small time, a number of leads but no arrests as yet. Have you found the Everson boy? Not yet, and I don't like the looks of it. You think something has happened to him? Perhaps. I believe you have a contact from Dimitri. I had said nothing about this contact when I told my story in O'Brien's office. Perhaps it is time to use it. I will. Your presence in South America would be most valuable. It so happens that client who wishes to remain anonymous is prepared to retain you in this connection. You will find $30,000 deposited to your bank account in Lima. Well, I haven't finished this case yet. Perhaps you can bring the Everson case to a speedy conclusion. He rang off. It would seem that I had been called upon to act. I got out a map and couldn't find the Callejon de la Esperanza. There are small streets in Mexico City you won't find on a map. I had a general idea as to where it was and I wanted to walk around. I've cracked cases like this with nothing to go on, just by getting out and walking around at random. It works best in a strange town or in a town you haven't visited for some time. We took a taxi to the Alameda, then started off in a northwesterly direction. Once we got off the main streets, I saw that the place hadn't changed all that much, the same narrow unpaved streets and squares, with booths selling tacos, fried grasshoppers, and peppermint candy covered with flies, the smell of pulque, urine, benzoin, chili, cooking oil, and sewage, and the faces bestial, evil, beautiful. A boy in white cotton shirt and pants, hair straight, skin smoky black, smelling faintly of vanilla and ozone. A boy with bright copper-red skin, innocent and beautiful as some exotic animal, leans against a wall eating an orange dusted with red pepper. American slithers by with long arms and buck teeth, eyes glistening, man with a bestial pan face reels out of a pulqueria, a hunchback dwarf shoots us a venomous glance. I was letting my legs guide me. Calle de los Desamparados, street of displaced persons, a pharmacia where an old junkie was waiting for his Rx. I got a whiff of phantom opium. Postcards in a dusty shop window. Poncho Villa posing with scowling men, gun belts and rifles. Three youths hanging from a makeshift scaffold, two with their pants down to the ankles, the other naked. The picture had been taken from behind, soldiers standing in front of them watching and grinning. Photos taken about 1914. The naked boy looked American, you can tell a blonde even in black and white. My legs pulled me in, Jim and Kiki following behind me. When I opened the door, a bell echoed through the shop. Inside, the shop was cool and dim with the smell of incense. A man came through a curtain and stood behind the counter. He was short and lightly built and absolutely bald, as if he had never had hair on his head. The skin was a yellowish brown, smooth as terracotta, the lips rather full, eyes jet black, forehead high and sloping back. There was a feeling of age about him, not that he looked old, but as he were a survivor of an ancient race, Oriental, Mayan, Negroid. All of these, but something else I had never seen in a human face. He was strangely familiar to me, and then I remembered where I had seen that face before. It was in the Mayan collection of the British Museum, a terracotta head about 3 inches in height. His lips moved into a slow smile and he spoke in perfect English without accent or inflection, eerie and remote as if coming from a great distance. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Could I see that postcard in the window? Certainly. That is what you have come for. It occurred to me that this must be Dimitri's contact, but this was not the address he had given. The Callejon de la Esperance. The Alley of Hope was destroyed in the earthquake. It has not been rebuilt. This way, gentlemen. He ushered us through a heavy door behind the curtain. When the door closed, it shut out all noise from the street. We were in a bare whitewashed room with heavy oak furniture lit by a barred window that opened onto a patio. He motioned us to chairs and got an envelope from a filing case and handed me a picture. It was an 8x10 replica of the postcard in the window. As I touched the picture, I got a whiff of the fever smell. Three youths were hanging from a pole supported by tripods, arms strapped to their sides by leather belts. There were two overturned sawhorses and a plank on the ground below them. The blonde boy was in the middle, two dark youths hanging on each side of him. The other two had their pants down to their ankles. The blonde boy was completely naked. Five soldiers stood in front of a barn looking up at the hanged men. One of the soldiers was very young, 16 or 17, with down on his chin and upper lip. He was looking up with his mouth open, his pants sticking out at the fly. The proprietor handed me a magnifying glass. The hanged boys quivered and writhed, necks straining against the ropes, buttocks contracting. Standing to one side, face in shadow, was the officer. I studied this figure through the glass. Something familiar. Oh yes, the dragon lady from Terry and the Pirates. It was a woman. And she bore a slight resemblance to young Everson. I pointed to the blonde boy. Do you have a picture of his face? He laid a picture on the table. The picture showed the boy's face and torso, his arms strapped to his sides. He was looking at something in front of him with a slack look on his face, as if he had just received an overwhelming shock and understood it completely. It was John Everson, or a close enough resemblance to be his twin brother. I showed him a snapshot of Everson I had in my pocket. He looked at it and nodded. Yes, it seems to be the same young man. Do you know who these people were? Yes. The three boys were revolutionaries. The blonde boy was the son of an American miner and a Spanish mother. He was born and raised in Durango and spoke no English. He was hanged on his 23rd birthday, September 24, 1914. The woman officer was his half-sister, 3 years older. She was finally ambushed and killed by Pancho Villa's men. I can assure you that young Everson is alive and well. He has simply forgotten his American identity. His memory can be restored. Unlike Jerry Green, he fell into comparatively good hands. You will meet them tonight. Lola Lachata is holding her annual party. Lola? Is she still operating? She has her little time concession. You will be back in the days of Allende. The Iguana twins will be there. They will take you to Everson. And now? He showed us out the back way onto an unpaved street. I think you will get a ride to Lola's. Lola's was quite a walk from where we were, and it was not an area for taxis. Also, I was a little confused as to directions. A Cadillac careened around the corner and screamed to a stop in a cloud of dust. A man in Glen plaid suit leaned out of the front seat. Going to the party? Get in, cabrones. We got into the back seat. There were two machos in the front seat and two on the jump seats. As we sped through the dirt streets, they blasted at cats and chickens with their 45s, missing with every shot as the vecinos dove for cover. Poor Convencion Zapata. The general's car stops in front of Lupita's place, which in a slum area of unpaved streets, looks like an abandoned warehouse. The door is opened by an old skull-faced pistolero with his black jacket open, a tip-up 44 Smith & Wesson strapped to his lean flank. The pistolero steps aside and we walk into a vast room with a high-beamed ceiling. The furniture is heavy black oak and red brocade, suggesting a Mexican country estate. In the middle of the room is a table with platters of tamales and tacos, beans, rice, and guacamole, beer in tubs of ice, bottles of tequila, bowls of marijuana and cigarette papers. The party is just starting and a few guests stand by the table puffing marijuana and drinking beer. On a smaller table, syringes are laid out with glasses of water and alcohol. Along one wall are curtained booths. Lola Lachata sits in a massive oak chair facing the door, 300 pounds cut from the mountain rock of Mexico, her graciousness underlining her power. She extends a massive arm, ah, Meester's nod. El Puerco Particular, the private pig. She shakes with laughter. And your handsome young assistants. She shakes hands with Jim and Kiki. You do well by yourself, Meester's nod. And you, Lola. You are younger, if anything. She waves a hand to the table. Please serve yourselves. I think an old friend of yours is already here. I start towards the table and recognize Bernabe Avogado. Clem. Bernabe. We got into an embrace and I can feel the pearl-handled 45 under his Glen Plat jacket. He is drinking Old Par scotch and there are four bottles on the table. He pours scotch into glasses as I introduce Jim and Kiki. Practically everybody in Mexico drinks scotch. Then he laughs and pounds me on the back. Clem, meet the iguanas, this very good friend. I shake hands with two of the most beautiful young people I have ever seen. They both have smooth greenish skin, black eyes, a reptilian grace. I can feel the strength in the boy's hand. They are incredibly poised and detached, their faces stamped with the same ancient lineage as the shop proprietor. They are the iguana twins. Junkies arrive and pay court to Lupita. She rewards them with papers of heroin fished from between her massive dugs. They are fixing at the table of syringes. Tonight everything is free, says the iguana sister. Mañana es otra cosa. The room is rapidly filling with whores and thieves, pimps and hustlers. Uniformed cops get in line and Lupita rewards each of them with an envelope. Plainclothesmen come in and shove to the head of the line. Their envelopes are thicker. Bernabe beckons to a young Indian policeman who has just received a thin envelope. The policeman approaches shyly. Bernabe pounds him on the back. This cabron get cockeyed borracho and kill two people. I get him out of jail. Other guests are arriving, the glamorous upper crust and jet set from costume parties. Some are in Mayan and Aztec dress. They bring various animals, monkeys, ocelots, iguanas, and a parrot who screams insults. The machos chase a terrified squealing peccary around the room. A rustle of excitement sweeps through the guests. Here's Mr. Coca-Cola. He's the real thing. Mr. Coca-Cola circulates among the guests selling packets of cocaine. As the cocaine takes effect, the tempo of the party accelerates. The general turns to a spider monkey perched on top of his chair. Here, cabron, have a sniff. He holds up a thumbnail with a pinch of cocaine. The monkey bites his hand, drawing blood. The cocaine spills down his coat. Chingo, you son of a whore. The general leaps up and jerks out his 45, blasting at the monkey from a distance of a few feet and missing with every shot as the guests hit the deck, dodge behind chairs, and roll under the table. Lupita lifts a finger. 50 feet away across the room, the old pistolero draws his long-barreled 44, aims and fires in one smooth movement, killing the monkey. The display of power intimidates even the machos and there is a moment of silence as a servant removes the dead monkey and wipes up the blood. A number of couples and some trios retire to the curtained booths. Another contingent of guests has arrived, among whom I recognize American narcotics agents. One of them is talking with a Mexican lawyer. I feel so sorry for these American boys in jail here for the cocaine, the lawyer says. And for the girls, even sorrier. I do what I can to get them out, but it is most difficult. Our laws are very strict. Much stricter than yours. In a search booth, which is also one of the booths at Lupita's party, a naked American girl with two uniformed police. The general and the lawyer enter from a door at the rear of the booth. One of the cops points to a packet of cocaine on a shelf. She have it in her pussy, señores. At a gesture from the general, the cops exit, grinning like monkeys. "We feel so sorry for your pussy frozen in the snow," says the general, taking off his pants. "I am the Big Thaw." A giggling macho pulls aside a curtain in front of the booth. "Good pussy, cabrones." Two Chapultepec blondes nudge each other and chant in unison, "Isn't he marvelous?" Never repeats himself. The macho pulls aside the curtain of the next booth. "He fuck her in the dry hole." Never repeats himself. In the end booth, Apuk, the Mayan god of death, is fucking the young corn god. As the curtains are jerked aside, they reach orgasm and the young corn god is spattered with black spots of decay. A nitrous haze like vaporized fish steams off their bodies. The macho gasps, coughs, and drops dead of a heart attack. Never repeats himself. Lupita gestures. Indian servants load the body onto a stretcher and carry it out. The party resumes at an even more hectic pace. The gas released by the copulations of life and death acts on the younger guests like catnip. They strip off their clothes, rolling around on mattresses which are spread out on the floor by wooden-faced servants. They exchange masks and do strip teases with scarves while others roll on their backs, legs in the air, applauding with their feet. The iguana touched my arm. "Will you and your two helpers please come with me? We have matters to discuss in private." She led us through a side door and down a long corridor to an elevator. The elevator opened onto a short hall at the end of which was another door. She motioned us into a large loft apartment furnished in Moroccan and Mexican style with rugs, low table, a few chairs, and couches. I declined a drink but accepted a joint. "The postcard vendor tells me you can help us locate John Everson," I began. She nodded. I remembered that I had not heard her brother say anything. He had nodded and smiled when we were introduced. He sat beside her now on a low couch, looking serene rather than bored. Jim, Kiki, and I sat opposite in three-seater chairs from Santa Fe. "We have many places here." A wave of her hand brought the benzoin smell of New Mexico into the room. It was a lovely place, but they had to spoil it with their idiotic bombs. "Oh yes, John Everson, such a nice boy, modern and convenient. You found him, so, of course." She turned to her brother, who smiled and licked his lips. "Well, he is in Durango with relatives, in excellent condition, considering the transfer of identities. Such operations may leave the patient a hospital case for months. This generally means that the operations has not been skillfully performed, or that discordant entities have been lodged in the same body. In Everson's case, there have been no complications. We had to give the Mexican identity sufficient time for a transfer to take place. Now it only remains to blend the two and he will recover his own identity, with fluent Spanish and a knowledge of rural Mexico which will be useful in his profession. In this case, the two identities are so similar that there will be no disharmony. And the spirit of El Gringo now has a home. He could not enter the cycle of rebirth because his karma required a duplicate death. This was done by electric brain stimulation which seems completely real to the patient. As you know, a difficulty in organ transplants is that they are rejected as a foreign body. Drugs must be administered to suspend the rejection. In this case, the shared experience of being hanged will dissolve the rejection that would otherwise occur, giving rise to the phenomenon of multiple personalities, where only one personality can occupy the body at one time. The hanging experience acts as a solvent. The two personalities will blend into one. John Everson will contact his parents, and tell them that he suffered a lapse of memory owing to a light concussion but is now completely recovered. I leaned back. Well, that wraps that case up. You have been retained to act against the Countess, $30,000. Does that seem enough to you? Well, considering what we are expected to do, no. And considering that you are all inexperienced and susceptible, this is virtually a suicide mission. I am prepared to retain you at a fair price and provide contacts which will give you at least some chance of success. She led the way into a bare room with chairs, a long table, and filing cabinets along one wall. I recognized the room as a replica of the room in back of the postcard vendor's shop. She went to the filing cabinet and handed me a short pamphlet bound in heavy parchment. On the cover in red letters, Cities of the Red Night. Book 2. Cities of the Red Night. The cities of the Red Night were six in number: Tamagis, Baedan, Yaswada, Wakdas, Nafana, and Gadis. These cities were located in an area roughly corresponding to the Gobi Desert, 100,000 years ago. At that time the desert was dotted with large oases and traversed by a river which emptied into the Caspian Sea. The largest of these oases contained a lake 10 miles long and 5 miles across, on the shores of which the university town of Wakdas was founded. Pilgrims came from all over the inhabited world to study in the academies of Wakdas, where the arts and sciences reached peaks of attainment that have never been equaled. Much of this ancient knowledge is now lost. The towns of Baedan and Yaswada were opposite each other on the river. Tamagis, located in a desolate area to the north on a small oasis, could properly be called a desert town. Nafana and Gadis were situated in mountainous areas to the west and south beyond the perimeter of usual trade routes between the other cities. In addition to the six cities, there were a number of villages and nomadic tribes. Food was plentiful and for a time the population was completely stable, no one was born unless someone died. The inhabitants were divided into an elite minority known as the transmigrants and a majority known as the receptacles. Within these categories were a number of occupational and specialized strata, and the two classes were not in practice separate. Transmigrants acted as receptacles and receptacles became transmigrants. To show the system in operation, here is an old transmigrant on his deathbed. He has selected his future receptacle parents, who are summoned to the death chamber. The parents then copulate, achieving orgasm just as the old transmigrant dies, so that his spirit enters the womb to be reborn. Every transmigrant carries with him at all times a list of alternative parents, and in case of accident, violence, or sudden illness, the nearest parents are rushed to the scene. However, there was at first little chance of random or unexpected death, since the Council of Transmigrants in Wakdas had attained such skill in the art of prophecy that they were able to chart a life from birth to death and determine in most cases the exact time and manner of death. Many transmigrants preferred not to wait for the infirmities of age and the ravages of illness, lest their spirit be so weakened as to be overwhelmed and absorbed by the receptacle child. These hardy transmigrants, in the full vigor of maturity, after rigorous training in concentration and astral projection, would select two death guides to kill them in front of the copulating parents. The methods of death most commonly employed were hanging and strangulation, the transmigrant dying in orgasm, which was considered the most reliable method of ensuring a successful transfer. Drugs were also developed, large doses of which occasioned death in erotic convulsions, smaller doses being used to enhance sexual pleasure. And these drugs were often used in conjunction with other forms of death. In time, death by natural causes became a rare and rather discreditable occurrence as the age for transmigration dropped. The Eternal Youths, a transmigrant sect, were hanged at the age of 18 to spare themselves the coarsening experience of middle age and the deterioration of senescence, living their youth again and again. Two factors undermine the stability of this system. The first was perfection of techniques for artificial insemination. Whereas the traditional practice called for one death and one rebirth, now hundreds of women could be impregnated from a single sperm collection, and territorially oriented transmigrants could populate whole areas with their progeny. There were sullen mutters of revolt from the receptacles, especially the women. At this point, another factor totally unforeseen was introduced. In the thinly populated desert area north of Tamagis, a portentous event occurred. Some say it was a meteor that fell to Earth, leaving a crater 20 miles across. Others say that the crater was caused by what modern physicists call a black hole. After this occurrence, the whole northern sky lit up red at night, like the reflection from a vast furnace. Those in the immediate vicinity of the crater were the first to be affected, and various mutations were observed, the commonest being altered hair and skin color. Red and yellow hair, and white, yellow, and red skin appeared for the first time. Slowly the whole area was similarly affected until the mutants outnumbered the original inhabitants, who were, as all human beings were at the time, black. The women, led by an albino mutant known as the White Tigress, seized Yaswata, reducing the male inhabitants to slaves, consorts, and courtiers, all under sentence of death that could be carried out at any time at the caprice of the White Tigress. The council in Wactus countered by developing a method of growing babies in excised wombs, the wombs being supplied by vagrant womb snatchers. This practice aggravated the differences between the male and female factions and was, with Yaswata, seemed unavoidable. In Nafana, a method was found to transfer the spirit directly into an adolescent receptacle, thus averting the awkward and vulnerable period of infancy. This practice required a rigorous period of preparation and training to achieve a harmonious blending of the two spirits in one body. These transmigrants, combining the freshness and vitality of youth with the wisdom of many lifetimes, were expected to form an army of liberation to free Yaswata. And there were adepts who could die at will without any need of drugs or executioners and project their spirit into a chosen receptacle. I have mentioned hanging, strangulation, and orgasm drugs as the commonest means of effecting the transfer. However, many other forms of death were employed. The fire boys were burned to death in the presence of the receptacles, only the genitals being insulated, so that the practitioner could achieve orgasm in the moment of death. There is an interesting account by a fire boy who recalled his experience after transmigrating in this manner. As the flames closed round my body, I inhaled deeply, drawing fire into my lungs, and screamed out flames as the most horrible pain turned to the most exquisite pleasure, and I was ejaculating in an adolescent receptacle who was being sodomized by another. Others were stabbed, decapitated, disemboweled, shot with arrows, or killed by a blow on the head. Some threw themselves from cliffs, landing in front of the copulating receptacles. The scientists at Wactus were developing a machine that could directly transfer the electromagnetic field of one body to another. In Gaddis there were adepts who were able to leave their bodies before death and occupy a series of hosts. How far this research may have gone will never be known. It was a time of great disorder and chaos. The effects of the Red Knight on receptacles and transmigrants proved to be incalculable, and many strange mutants arose as a series of plagues devastated the cities. It is this period of war and pestilence that is covered by the books. The Council had set out to produce a race of supermen for the exploration of space. They produced instead races of ravening idiot vampires. Finally, the cities were abandoned and the survivors fled in all directions, carrying the plagues with them. Some of these migrants crossed the Bering Strait into the New World, taking the books with them. They settled in the area later occupied by the Mayans, and the books eventually fell into the hands of the Mayan priests. The alert student of this noble experiment will perceive that death was regarded as equivalent not to birth but to conception, and go on to infer that conception is the basic trauma. In the moment of death, the dying man's whole life may flash in front of his eyes back to conception. In the moment of conception, his future life flashes forward to his future death. To re-experience conception is fatal. This was the basic error of the transmigrants: you do not get beyond death and conception by re-experience any more than you get beyond heroin by ingesting larger and larger doses. The transmigrants were quite literally addicted to death, and they needed more and more death to kill the pain of conception. They were buying parasitic life with a promissory death note to be paid at a pre-arranged time. The transmigrants then imposed their terms on the host child to ensure his future transmigration. There was a basic conflict of interest between the host child and transmigrant. So the transmigrants reduced the receptacle class to a condition of virtual idiocy. Otherwise they would have reneged on a bargain from which they stood to gain nothing but death. The books are flagrant falsifications. And some of these basic lies are still current. Nothing is true. Everything is permitted. The last words of Hassan Isabag, Old Man of the Mountain. Tamagis. Baidan. Yaswata. Wactus. Nafana. Gaddis. It is said that an initiate who wishes to know the answer to any question need only repeat these words as he falls asleep and the answer will come in a dream. Tamagis, this is the open city of contending partisans where advantage shifts from moment to moment in a desperate biological war. Here everything is as true as you think it is and everything you can get away with is permitted. B.A. Dan, this city is given over to competitive games and commerce. B.A. Dan closely resembles present-day America with a precarious moneyed elite, a large disaffected middle class and an equally large segment of criminals and outlaws. Unstable, explosive, and swept by whirlwind riots. Everything is true and everything is permitted. Yaswada, this city is the female stronghold where the Countess de Gulpa, the Countess de Vile, and the Council of the Selected plot a final subjugation of the other cities. Every shade of sexual transition is represented, boys with girls' heads, girls with boys' heads. Here everything is true and nothing is permitted except to the permitters. Wakdas, this is the university city, the center of learning where all questions are answered in terms of what can be expressed and understood. Complete permission derives from complete understanding. Nafana and Gaddis are the cities of illusion where nothing is true and therefore everything is permitted. The traveler must start into Magis and make his way through the other cities in the order named. This pilgrimage may take many lifetimes. Get out of the defensive position. We now have a sufficient stockpile of the new weapons to initiate our campaign, and it seems unwise to delay longer. Sooner or later the enemy will learn something of our plans and the means we possess to implement them. We will apply the classic rules of hit and run warfare against a larger force, drawing them deeper into our territory while raiding and cutting supply lines. This is the tactic that beat Crassus's Roman legions in the disastrous Parthian campaign. The Parthians would suddenly appear over a rise mounted on horses, loose a shower of arrows and ride away, luring the Romans deeper and deeper into the desert as thirst, hunger, and disease took their toll. Only a handful of the legionnaires made their way back to the sea. Once this tactic has sufficiently weakened the enemy, we will shift to an all-out attack on a series of enemy positions. Failure to follow through on a successful attack is as disastrous as attempting an attack against unfavorable odds. It was this error that lost Hannibal the war against Rome. He did not realize that he had beaten the whole Roman army, so instead of marching on the unprotected city without delay, he retrenched to consolidate his position until he had no position left. We can expect a landslide of defections to our cause, and we must follow through to deliver a series of knockout blows. Nor will we allow time for the French and English to recognize the danger and join Spain against a common enemy. As soon as we see victory on the way in the southern hemisphere of the American continent, we will strike in the northern hemisphere. Then we will open a diplomatic offensive concentrating on England to negotiate treaties, trade agreements, and recognition of our independent and sovereign status. Of course, the new weapons will be common knowledge in a short time, but by then we will have a lead that will be difficult to overtake. We will be able to produce the weapons in any quantity, and by attracting inventors, skilled workers, and technicians with higher wages and better living conditions, we can continue to turn out better weapons than our adversaries. We have also the incalculable advantage of a huge territory virtually impossible to invade successfully, whereas European countries, with the exception of Russia, are vulnerable to invasion, since they have no place to retreat to. We expect the articles to spread through Africa, the Near and Far East, and we could invade Spain from North Africa. Our immediate plan is to provoke the Spanish into a massive attack by taking Panama City and Guayaquil. This should divert much of the Pacific Fleet to those two locations and dispatch land forces from Lima to Guayaquil and from Cartagena to Panama. If necessary, we shall retreat into the swamps of southern Panama and to the mountainous and heavily wooded areas northwest of the city. In the event of decisive land victories, we will immediately launch attacks on the depleted garrisons at Lima and Cartagena, inflict what damage we can on the fleet, and at the same time, strike in Mexico. The Iguana twins have returned to Mexico to organize our movement there, and Bert Hansen has gone with them. Captain Strobe has gone to Panama to assess the strength of the Spanish garrison and to organize partisan resistance to the north and east of the city. The area to the south is already in our hands. Juanito and Brady, with a force of 50 men, have gone south to set up fortified positions west of Guayaquil from which the attack on the city can be launched and to which our forces can withdraw, luring the Spanish ground forces into a deadly trap. The sea battles will be directed by Opium Jones, Skipper Nordenhals, and Captain Strobe. A number of destroyers are under construction. Then one morning we received word on the signal drums that Captain Strobe had been taken in Panama City and sentenced to hang. On receipt of this news, we set out for Panama City with a force of 50 men armed with the double-barreled rifles and a good stock of mortars, both of the type that explode on contact and those that explode from timed fuses. We had little hope of arriving in time, so we sent back word to the local partisans to take what measures they could to effect a rescue, that an expeditionary force was on the way. Marching day and night without sleep, on opium and yucca, we were 5 miles south of the city at dawn on the third day. A warm mist enveloped us and I was reminded of the steam bath in my little Michigan lake town and found myself walking with an erection. Suddenly we heard a terrific explosion from the direction of Panama City and stopped, our faces lifted to the rising sun. Shortly thereafter, a runner informed us that Captain Strobe had been rescued and was heading south in a fishing boat towards one of Pacific bases opposite the Pearl Islands. We instructed the runner to inform the Spanish garrison that the pirates who had engineered the destruction of the armory and the escape of Captain Strobe were just south of the city, that they were few in number and almost out of powder. As we had hoped, the Spanish fell into our trap and immediately dispatched a column of soldiers in pursuit, leaving only 100 to guard the city. The country here is low hills with outcroppings of limestone, ideally suited for ambush. We select a narrow valley between slopes strewn with limestone boulders. Rocky terrain is the best for mortar attacks. We dispose 20 men on each slope, about 50 yards from the path the Spanish column will take. The remaining 10 will serve as decoys, fleeing as the soldiers approach. Once the concealed riflemen open up on the enemy flanks, they will seek cover and fire directly into the Spanish column, who will then be caught in a three-way fire. Concealed behind boulders, we settle down to wait. It is not long before the Spanish appear. There are about 200 men in the column, with four officers on horseback. As they catch sight of the decoys, the officers urge their horses on, shouting to the men to follow. The lead officer, a major, is leaning forward in the saddle, his sword raised, his teeth bared under a bristling black mustache. Using a rifle with contact mortar, I take careful aim, leading the horse by 4 feet to allow for forward speed. Even so, I miscalculate slightly, and the mortar hits the horse in the withers instead of in the shoulder as I had intended. The explosion blows the major out of the saddle and over the horse's head. His sword flies out of his severed right hand in a glittering arc. The horse rears, screaming and kicking, entrails spilling from a gaping hole. My shot is the signal for the others to open up, bouncing mortars off boulders by the foot soldiers and under the horses. One officer whirls and gallops back towards the city. After 2 rounds of mortar fire, we shift to the double-barreled rifles. In a few minutes, all but a handful are dead or dying and the survivors are fleeing back to the city in a blind panic. I give the signal to hold fire, since the accounts carried by the fugitives will place our number at 500 to 800. The rumor of a large force of well-armed privateers, probably English, will spread panic in the city, whose defenders are now reduced to a scant 100 men. We advance to the outskirts of the city, where a party of officers display a flag of truce to indicate that they wish to parley. We state our terms as immediate and unconditional surrender of the garrison and the city, telling the officers that we have better than 800 men behind us. If they surrender the city, we promise to spare the lives of the governor, the officers and soldiers, and all the inhabitants. If not, we will kill any who offer the slightest resistance, and will sack and burn the city. They have no option except to agree. Meanwhile, about 300 local partisans have gathered, armed with weapons taken from the dead, since we do not want the officers to see the new weapons until we are able to effectively seal the city. We then stipulate that all soldiers, officers, and armed civilians must come to this spot and lay down their arms. Anyone subsequently found in possession of arms will be summarily executed. The soldiers, having laid down their arms, are ordered to remove their uniforms, boots, and socks. Clad only in undergarments, they are marched to the garrison and locked in. The officers, the governor, the wealthy inhabitants, and the clergy, protesting the indignity, are locked in the prison after all the prisoners have been released. We post notices to the inhabitants to go about their daily business and to fear no harm. We set up the articles in public places, impound all ships in the harbor, and post guards at all exits. No boat may leave the harbor and no person may leave the city. For the next 2 days, while we are catching up on our sleep, the soldiers, officers, and hostages are to be given adequate food, but the partisans who guard them and bring the food have orders not to talk or to answer any questions. On the third day, fully rested, we gather around a conference table in the governmental dining room. News of our success has spread throughout the area, and there are now more than 500 partisans gathered in the city, more than enough for routine guard duty. We consult maps and formulate plans for a series of attacks on the Spanish-held garrisons on the east side of the isthmus. These garrisons are for the most part small, and will be no match for our mortars. Within a month, we will control a string of garrisons from Port Roger to northern Panama. It is decided that the post of Comandante shall rotate each day. Since the ambush was largely according to my plan, I will assume the first shift. We are the language. As I was reading the Cities of the Red Knight text, the Iguana sister brought some books and put them down on the table. I laid aside the folder. Who wrote this? A scholar who prefers to remain anonymous. Research into this area is not reinforced. If, as he suggests, conception is the basic trauma, then it is also the basic instrument of control. She gestured to the books stacked on the table. I saw at a glance that they were elaborately bound in a variety of colors. They looked very expensive. These are copies. Please study them carefully. I will pay $1 million for recovery of the originals. How good are the copies? Almost perfect. Then why do you want the originals? Collector's vanity. Changes, Mr. Snide, can only be affected by alterations in the original. The only thing not pre-recorded in a pre-recorded universe are the pre-recordings themselves. The copies can only repeat themselves word for word. A virus is a copy. You can pretty it up, cut it up, scramble it will reassemble in the same form. Without being an idealist, I am reluctant to see the originals in the hands of the Countess de Gulpa, the Countess de Vile and the Pickle Factory. I don't need a pep talk but I do need a retainer. She laid out a check for 200,000 kools on the table. I began examining the books, skipping through to get a general impression. They are composed in a variety of styles and periods. Some of them seem to stem from the 1920s of the Great Gatsby, Old Sport, and others to derive from the Edwardian era of Saki, reflecting an unbearably flawed boyishness. There is an underlying current of profound frivolity, with languid young aristocrats drawling epigrams in streets of disease, war, and death. There is a Rover Boys Tom Swift storyline where boy heroes battle against desperate odds. The books are color comics. Jokes, Jim calls them. Some lost color process has been used to transfer three-dimensional holograms onto the curious tough translucent parchment-like material of the pages. You ache to look at these colors. Impossible reds, blues, sepias. Colors you can smell and taste and feel with your whole body. Children's books against a Bosch background, legends, fairy stories, stereotyped characters, surface motivations with a child's casual cruelty. What facts could have given rise to such legends? A form of radiation unknown at the present time activated a virus. This virus illness occasioned biologic mutations, especially alterations in hair and skin color, which were then genetically conveyed. The virus must have affected the sexual and fear centers in the brain and nervous system so that fear was converted into sexual frenzies which were reconverted into fear, the feedback leading in many cases to a fatal conclusion. The virus information was genetically conveyed, in orgasms that were often fatal. It seems likely that the burnings, stabbings, poisonings, stranglings, and hangings were largely terminal hallucinations produced by the virus, at a point where the line between illusion and reality breaks down. Over a period of generations, the virus established a benign symbiosis with the host. It was a mutating virus, a color virus, as if the colors themselves were possessed of a purposeful and sinister life. The books are probably no more representative of life at the time than a Saturday Evening Post cover by Norman Rockwell represents the complex reality of American life. Are these complete copies of the originals I am retained to find, or should I say uncover? No, these are fragments. You have some idea as to what the other books contain? I asked. She glanced at the check. Do you? I nodded. They may contain the truth, which these books cover with a surface so horrible and so nauseously prettified that it remains impervious as a mirror. I put the check in my wallet. And as misleading, I added. I returned to the books. As I read on, I became increasingly aware of a feeling of faintness and malaise. The colors were giving me a headache: the deep electric blue of the southern sky, the explosions of green by the pools and waterways, the clothes of tight-fitting red velvet, the purples, red, and pinks of diseased skin rising from the books, palpable as a haze, a poisonous miasma of color. I loosened my collar, my thoughts hazy and somehow not my own, as if someone were delivering a lecture on the books, of which I caught an occasional phrase, captions in English. At one time a language existed that was immediately comprehensible to anyone with the concept of language. A World War I ambulance. As I tried to examine it more closely, I could not be sure, but I had seen it with photographic clarity, an old sepia photo circa 1917. They have removed the temporal limits. I looked up with a start, as if I had been dozing. The iguana and her brother were not in the room. I had not seen them go. Jim was sitting on one side of me and Kiki on the other. They seemed to be equally affected. "Whoa," said Jim. "I need a good hooker of brandy." "Mui miriadu," said Kiki. "No kier over moss." Jim and Kiki walk over to a cabinet bar in the corner of the room. I pick up a book bound in red skin. In a deeper shade of red, the first redhead. A blonde boy with a noose around his neck blushes deeper and deeper, red washing through his body, his lips swelling as the red tide sweeps into his hair and ripples down his chest to the crotch, down his legs, dusting his skin with red hairs that glisten in a soft fire, heart pounding against his ribs like a caged bird. I pick up a book with a heavy blue cover like flexible metal. In gold letters, The Blue Mutant. As I open the book, I get a whiff of ozone. A boy with a blue rash around his crotch, neck, and nipples, burning his asshole and crotch, a slow cold burn behind his ear, the blue color in his eyes, pale blue of northern skies washed across the whites, the pupils deep purple, blue shit burning in his ass like melting solder. The smell of the blue mutant fever fills the room, a rotten metal meat smell that steams off him as he shits a smoldering blue phosphorescent excrement. His pubic and rectal hairs turn bright blue and crackle with sparks. I was looking at the books from above in a spacecraft coming in for a landing. A purple twilight lay over the sad languorous city. We were driven to a villa on the outskirts of Lima. The house was surrounded by the usual high wall, topped with broken glass like sugar crystals on a cake. Two floors, balcony on the second floor, bougainvillea climbing over the front of the house. The driver carried the luggage in and gave us the keys. He also gave me a guidebook in which certain shops and business addresses were checked. We had a look around. The furniture looked like a window display, solid, expensive, undistinguished. Glassed bookcases were filled with leather-bound encyclopedias, Dickens, Thackeray, Kipling, books on the flora and fauna of South America, bird books, and books on navigation. Nowhere did I see any indication that anyone had ever lived there. Consulting a map of Lima, on a glass-covered coffee table spread with some issues of the National Geographic, I looked up the addresses. All in or near the Mercado Mayorista. One was an art supply store. I had already decided to fabricate the complete books if I could find the right paper. In fact, I felt sure that this was exactly what I was being paid to do. An address in the Mercado was Bloom and Krupp Import Export. This was my contact. The Mercado Mayorista of Lima occupies about 4 square blocks. Here vegetables, fruits, pigs, chickens, and other produce are brought in by truck from all over Peru to be unloaded and sold. The shops, booths, bars, and restaurants are open 24 hours a day. The only thing comparable to the Mercado Mayorista is the Jmulfna of Marrakesh. The Jmulfna, however, has been a tourist attraction for so long that millions of cameras have sucked its vitality and dimmed its colors. The Mercado is seldom visited by tourists and is not conceived as a folkloric spectacle. It has a definite function and the folklore is incidental. Street performers gather here because there are always spectators with money. We walked on, passing little restaurants serving hot fish soup, meat on spits, brown bread, bars with jukeboxes and boys dancing, Chinese restaurants, snake charmers, a trick bicycle rider, trained monkeys. Very faintly I could hear the pipes of Pan. Some distance away there was a small circle of onlookers. A boy was playing a bamboo flute. He was about 15 years old, with yellow hair, blue eyes, and a dusting of freckles on a broad face. Looking into the boy's eyes, I experienced a shock of recognition. His eyes were blank and empty as the blue sky over the market, devoid of any human expression, Pan, the goat god. The music went on playing in my head, trickled down mountainsides in a blue twilight, rustling through glades and grass, twinkling on starlit streams, drifting down windy streets with autumn leaves. I decided to visit the art supply store alone. What I wanted would be under the counter. Anyone handling that kind of paper and ink would be into art forgery, probably passports and documents as well. Two visitors would queer the deal. Kiki wanted to look around the town anyway, and Jim needed some photographic equipment. The store was on a dingy narrow street near the market. There were some dusty canvases, easels, and tubes of paint in the window, reminiscent of the rubber sandwiches served in Swedish bars to legitimize the sale of liquor. When I tried the door, I found that it was locked. I knocked, and the door was finally opened by a middle-aged man with heavy rimless glasses who looked at me suspiciously. Vous voulez du papier, monsieur? Entrez. He stood aside and locked the door behind me. A fattish woman with frizzy blonde hair and large diamonds on her liver-spotted fingers sat at an ancient cash register. She had been reading Le Figaro, which lay on the counter. She looked frightened. So did he. War criminals, I decided matter-of-factly. French collaborators. J.A.I. besoin de papier pour un tâche speciale. Delivers qui devrait yent paratre anciens. He nodded and something like a smile touched his thin lips. P.A.R.I.C.I., monsieur. He led the way to a back room containing a long oak table and several chairs. Iron cabinets with cylinder locks occupied one wall. He looked at me sharply. Ah oui. He gestured to the cabinets. List war, monsieur, à votre disposition, quelle époque? Vous cherchez peut être un codex Mayan? Un papyrus d'Egypte? Quelque chose du Moyen Age? Plus recent. Dix Huisham, environ 1702. Etel auteur, monsieur. Gentilhomme, courtesan, voleur. And the author? Gentleman, courtesan, thief. Pirate American. Parfaitement. He opened a little casket with a key from his vest pocket and selected from it another key. With this he opened a cabinet in which I could see packages in cubby holes, and brought out several packets tied and sealed with red wax. De Boston. Parfaitment. I examined the parchment carefully, holding it up to the light and looking at it under a magnifying glass. I nodded and smiled. Très bien. De Elancre. Oui. He opened another cabinet full of bottles and jars and tubes. C.A. I brought out my portable kit and ran some tests.